Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. My name's Rachel Smith. I'm the COO with ExchangeWire. Delighted to have here in the studio today our very special guest, visiting all the way from New York City, Ronan Shields, ad tech correspondent with Adweek. Hello, Ronan.
Hi, Rachel. Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm delighted. And, of course, ExchangeWire's CEO, Kieran O'Kane. Kieran, how are you today?
I'm feeling very rough today. We had some farewell drinks for our friend Farzad last night.
Farzad Jamal, yeah. Who very sadly passed away a few weeks ago. And we had an industry wake for him yesterday evening.
It was great. So we all got very drunk and toasted his memory. It was very nice.
As Farzad would have wanted us to.
Absolutely. Hero. And he'd be sadly missed.
Very much so. Okay, on to the news this week in the world of advertising and marketing technology. First story that I wanted to chat with you two about today is Singles Day, the annual shopping festival, it's sometimes called, holiday season festival thing that happens in China and that generates an enormous amount of online and offline shopping revenue. And of course, this year it came out in the news in various sources, including Adweek, that revenue achieved by Alibaba was just through the roof, and something outrageous like in the first 10 minutes of sales, they managed to exceed what Amazon achieved during their latest Amazon Prime Day sale a few months ago in the whole day. I mean, that's kind of phenomenal, really. I wanted to know what you guys think about that. And Ronan, like I said, since Adweek produced an article on this, you might have a little bit more background info you'd like to share with us. And I also want to know what this says about this retail e-commerce giant in Southeast Asia, in Asia, because the other element to what they got up to this year was that they acquired Lazada, an e-commerce platform that was operating elsewhere in Southeast Asia earlier on in the year. And so this year, for the first year, they had that as part of their Singles Day kind of offering. So they extended all of those deals out to a few of the Southeast Asian regions as well. So what's Alibaba's enormously strong position here, and what's it doing to the world of e-commerce, and how acquisitive do you think they are outside of China?
Okay, well, the Winter Shopping Festival is what they used to call it whenever I lived in the Middle East. It was, nice bit of branding there. I didn't look at this personally, but shout out to my co-worker, Lisa Lacey. She wrote a very extensive piece on it, and I got her to write me a bit of a cheat sheet of some of the figures.
Cheating already, Ronan.
Well, you know, giving full accreditation where it's due.
Yeah, fair enough.
So the total revenue generated was $30.8 billion in 24 hours, which was the biggest shopping day by an absolute long shot in the history of commerce.
Yeah.
Which is just absolutely crazy figures. There was $1 billion in revenue done in a minute and 25 seconds. $1 billion. And $10 billion in an hour and 48 seconds. So it's bigger than Black Friday, as is about to come
many
up.
Many times over.
Yeah, I suppose. And it is also spreading out across Southeast Asia, as you said, but like Black Friday has spread from being solely a US marketing drive, let's just call it for what it is, to, you know, parts of Western Europe. So, yeah, it just goes to show the scale. It's absolutely nuts. So I'm guessing most people listening to this will be based in the West and just kind of like, you know, Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent. It's kind of like a little bit over there, but yeah, it can't be long before.
They're just a force to be reckoned with, right?
Yeah, just in numbers and multiples, it's just
absolutely
mind-boggling.
And it just can't be that long before it's a platform that people outside of Asia are shopping on, in my opinion. Kieran?
Well, it's China, innit?
It's
ginormous. I mean, I'd love to know how much they're actually making. I see these numbers and they're always a gross numbers. So I'd love to know what kind of margin they're making on this. If there's anybody who's got an estimate, please email me. In terms of, like, these platforms, like, China is such a huge base that it's just easy for these guys to move outside of China. And then their ambitions are, in the first instance, Southeast Asia. Because it's a mobile-first
environment,
it's easy for them to expand there. And Alibaba is well-known outside of China. A lot of people use it as a buying platform, like to acquire cheap goods. But obviously they have ambitions beyond that. I don't know, they've got a new chairman, I can't remember his name. He's replacing Jack Ma. And he did an interview with one of the Bloomberg podcasts. and he talked about their ambitions for the next 10 years. And they have grand ambitions to be the cloud leader, to overtake AWS, because they see that as a massive opportunity. Mm. And it is. It's a huge... I mean, everything is going to be cloud-based. I mean, nobody's using any desktop applications anymore. Everything's cloud-based. So they think that all software, enterprise and consumer software will be hosted in the cloud. So that's a huge opportunity for a couple of companies to expand there. Obviously, Microsoft and Amazon are the standout leaders. Amazon, in particular, built it from nothing to a $10 billion business. And it makes, I don't know, 30-40% margins on that. It's incredible. Mm. It's an incredible business. So I think Alibaba's obviously got grander ambitions. You know, they're the payment hub as well for the Chinese market. And obviously, they're going to acquire more companies. I don't know what they can acquire in Europe. I mean, Europe is definitely a market they could probably target. I mean, given the tensions in the US between, you know, the Trump's White House and China in particular, it'd be difficult to see how they could build or expand there without, you know, bumping into various regulatory issues.
Yep.
Whereas in Europe, they'd probably...
Have an easier run, you think.
But I think Alibaba is much more... It's interesting, like, you talk about Tencent. Like, Tencent is the operating system for most Chinese people, right? It's a messaging app, it's a payment app.
You can do so much on it.
Yeah.
It's so much more diverse than the sort of messaging apps that are popular here, you know, in the West.
That's a huge day for Alibaba, but they've got this... I can't remember the name of the company because it's pretty, like, unpronounceable for an Irishman.
And also you're a bit hungover.
Yeah, a little bit hungover, and I can't remember. But there's like, a low-cost platform now that's really eaten into their market in third tier Chinese cities. So obviously first and second tier Chinese cities, Alibaba rules the roost because of the infrastructure and the ability to deliver. But in the third tier cities, which are as big as European cities, probably some of these cities we've never heard of, Beijing, but they'd probably be twice the size of Paris, right? And there's probably 100 of them all over the country. And then there's another tier down. The Chinese ecosystem, like, this getting away from just the Alibaba pitch, but the Chinese ecosystem is fascinating, right? They're now building companies that are coming out. And you know, the news app and that app that was basically the musical. Is it musical?
Musical.ly?
Musical.ly, yeah. Which was basically the first, you know, proper homegrown social app that really wasn't trying to a copycat of another. That's an example of the Chinese are starting to kind of move and innovate. And they're mobile first. We're now a mobile first world, effectively. And the Chinese are straight ahead because all of their users have been that way for 10 years plus. So it's fascinating. I think this is a bigger story about, you know, the march of the Chinese tech companies.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting. You were talking about Western companies going over. If we look at the Trade Desk, you know, to bring it back to ad tech, the fact that Jeff Green relocated down there, he often talks about it on the last 2 to 3 earnings calls. I mean, I think that goes to show just how, you know, conversely, people are taking it very, very seriously. Mm. I remember, like, when I'd heard that he'd relocated from California to
Hong Kong.
Yeah, to that market. It was just really quite interesting. I never heard of anything quite like that before.
It's an unusual move. Are you sure it's something to do with the 0% tax rate?
I don't know. You tell me, Kieran.
Aspersions on Jeffrey's motivation. Yeah. Exactly.
You're one of my
favorites. We've got a lot of love for Jeff.
But it also just goes to show that if you are looking to break that market, you really got to get boots on the ground. It is, I mean, you guys
we have a lot of conversations about this, from our own perspective here at ExchangeWire, when we think about, because we've got quite a big business in Asia, but what do we do about China? And it's a constant topic of conversation. We had a really interesting guy come and speak at ACS Singapore this year, Graham Brown, who writes a report called Asia Matters, and he's a bit of an expert in Asian marketplace, including China. He said there's no two ways about the fact that China is more interested in the West than the West is interested in China. So he was saying it's not only that there's a massive opportunity in China, and of course a lot of Western companies scratch their heads about how they can actually tackle that and make the most of that potential opportunity, but he was saying that really smart, forward-thinking Chinese companies are completely obsessed with how they then move their businesses outside China and start expanding elsewhere. So you've got both things happening at the same time.
And you can see this, you can see why the Americans have become very anti-Chinese all of a sudden, because they're the coming power, right? It's the Asian, it's just not China,
the Asian
but
age.
It's the Asian century, right? because hot in the heels of China, you've got India, who will be the next superpower to emerge from that region. It's just the numbers, it's just demographics. And the way they do things is completely different. I mean, it's interesting. I know just kind of switching lanes here, but Apple's market share in Apple or in India is non-existent, right? So the Chinese phone makers who produce all of the phones, because the Indians have a very strict rule about outside produced goods, tariffs are quite high. So anybody who produces the phones inside India has a commercial advantage because they're cheaper to sell because they're having tariffs on top of them. So Chinese manufacturers have set up operations within India, and it's Indian foaming. And they're selling phones for the cheapest cost possible because Android's free, right? But the Apple phone is so expensive. So the way they do business, the way that they consume media is completely different. And American companies are not having it all their own way, right? They obviously scaled in the US because it's easy. It's an English-speaking market and it's easier.
It's relatively generic in that.
They come
sense,
to Europe, which is kind of a, you know, it's a generic sort of closely aligned region to the US. But once they get to Asia, it gets a bit more complicated.
I'm not sure I'd say Europe's generic and a direct comparison to the US.
Well, look at the success of European, of American
US companies
tech first.
It's been particularly
the British who are just, they're bend on one knee for the Americans. They love them so much.
The Irish got a lot of love for the Americans too.
Yeah, we're just a tax haven though. It's a difference. We have a lot of money.
Just one more point on this before we move on to the next story. Actually, it was on that sort of, I suppose, slightly different cultural approach to things. The thing that I think about, wonder about Singles Day is it also a basic reflection of consumption in China. Like, you know, everybody buys into this and purchases a lot of stuff on Singles Day. Now, I'm not saying that Black Friday doesn't sort of get a kind of almost comparable buzz, but I wonder if, the consumer mindset's a little bit different in Western countries and maybe a little bit more discerning or even just a little bit more
cynical.
Fatigued, cynical, that's the word, exactly. Whereas, you know, there are still so, you know, this burgeoning middle class, growing middle class in China that's ready to spend money, and are these single day figures a reflection of that?
That's a more of a socioeconomic question.
Is that too complicated for the podcast?
Maybe we should move on to the next subject because we spent 10 minutes chatting about this.
People are susceptible to marketing.
Yes. Do Chinese people click on more ads than Western? Yes. AdSense makes a lot more money in China. Let's move on
to
the next subject.
Yes. Kieran, I'm just going to remind you I'm moderating this session.
I know,
session,
we've 10 minutes in this.
Anyway. Moving on to the next story, which is the US Justice Department's investigation into the Snap IPO of early mid last year. So this was an article that appeared in Reuters, I think, yesterday, talking about the allegations that have been made by some investors that Snap misled the public about how competition from Instagram might affect their business. And there's further allegations that there's been, you know, sort of misreporting of user numbers. And my question to you two is, how important is this? How does this matter? And also, is it a reflection of investors just getting a bit naturally upset about Snap's sort of dwindling user numbers? Or does it say something about how these companies are being valued in an IPO context, which is all about a focus on how many users they can acquire?
Well, I probably just want to say, it's like, sounds a little bit familiar, this, doesn't it? If you've been around long enough, it just basically echoes the Facebook IPO. A couple of years ago, there was exactly the same things. Charges were alleged at them. And then the fact that, very early on, Facebook had no mobile monetization products. And look at it now, it's almost 90% of their revenue. So, it's eerie just how familiar this sounds.
Yeah.
That's all I'd say to begin with. I don't know about you, Kieran.
Look, this is utter bullshit. These lawsuits are ridiculous. It's like buyer beware, right? You know what you were buying into, it, right? It's a company that, like most of these internet companies, even including Facebook, are open to being disrupted at some stage, right?
Competition's going to come along, right?
And a fool could see from... Any idiot could see that Instagram was basically aping the design and user behavior that SnapPad, right? It's a clone of it, right? That's all it is. That's when Facebook bought it, they saw what Snap was doing, saw the growth patterns, and aped it for everything, right? And it basically stole its USP, right? And it was obvious that they were losing audience, right? The problem with IPOs is that they're rigged to have a big pop on the first or second day, and then the price gradually goes down. A lot, as you say, a lot of these companies are going public. Some of the tech companies have unrealistic valuations. Even Facebook's valuation right now is stupid. It's ridiculous. These are like momentum stocks. People just buy for the sake of buying, right? They're not like hold this stock for 10, 20 years, all right? They're not an Apple or an IBM or one of those sort of like stocks that over a 10-year or 20-year horizon will make you money, right? But the good thing about Snap is there's so much negativity about that company, but I actually think they have a lot of interesting stuff going on, right? The new user numbers are definitely slowing, if not dropping off, but their monthly active users, the people actually use that, is so sticky. They've got revenue growth, they're engaged, and they've gone almost all in and programmatic, and it's juiced the numbers. Yeah. So for me, Snap could be a really interesting middle tier company, right? It may not be able to compete with the stellar scale that Facebook has across all of its applications, right? But it will be a decent sized mid tier company with a highly engaged audience, which is what marketers want, right? These are not frivolous users. They are using Snap religiously, right? For communication, for sharing content, and they have had success. The biggest problem with Snap is its governance, and same with Facebook, right? Mark Zuckerberg is the governor for life, right? He can't be ousted. Hence the reason why there's a lot of irritation from investors because of governance around. The same is true with Evan Spiegel and his co-founder, what can't remember his name, Murphy, is it? Something Murphy, Irish lad. But the same problems there. They have unbelievable control without any sort of oversight from an independent chairman or the ability of the stockholders to vote out people or vote down specific things, that they have complete control. So governance is an issue, right?
So in a way, you sort of want to say to investors, what do you expect?
What did you expect? Yeah. You knew what we were getting. Stop suing these people. You're idiots. This has got no basis. They'll be thrown out. You see these court cases all the time. It's a litigation, litigious, is it a word? Country. Yep. They'd sue anything. You know what I mean? We'll probably get sued for this podcast, but go ahead.
Great. Look forward to that.
I speak to some people at Facebook privately, and
you got friends cases. At Facebook. Friend me.
I'm not even on Facebook as well.
Neither am I. 5 years clean.
Yeah. You talk to them privately about these court cases, and they just say, look, this is just pure litigious behavior. This just is nothing very much here. In the culture. They're not quite as flippant about it as all that, but they're like, this happens. You got to ride out the storm, etc. I don't know anybody personally at Snap, but I'd imagine that there must be a similar mindset of like, this is going to happen. This is just the cost of doing business.
Bound.
Snap will be a good sized company, but I actually think the share price is probably, it's the right price for them. I think they're worth a couple of billion, not like hundreds of billions. I think anybody with that expectation is an idiot. And we just would say, you go out and burn your money, right? Just, remember the stock market in many ways is like a gambling pit, right? You can either take the long view, which is what the likes of, what do you call him? The famous, Sage Omaha, what's his name? Anyway, you can take that long view, right, and put money in companies with the view of growing that business, or you take short term bets, and this is what like it will snap you around 10 years. Who knows? I mean, the world is moving so quickly in that space; it could be dead in 5 years, or it could be acquired
by a Chinese company.
Or Amazon, Scott Galloway said Amazon. That could be an interesting bet.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, okay, well, we've already started on this topic anyway. So third news story that I wanted to move on to, published in DigiDay earlier on this week about Facebook shutting down their connected TV side of their ad network. And they're going to be stopping selling ads inside publishers' OTT apps by January, early next year. So why is my question? There's obviously a couple of theories put forward. The first being, seeing that, players within the connected TV space are kind of building their own successful advertising businesses. And if you like, creating their own walled gardens, Roku being the prime example there, because the advertising business is growing fairly steadily. And I think the other suggestion that was put forward as well is that Facebook didn't really do a great job of making the right advertisers aware of the availability of that OTT inventory. And in fact, they should have tried to focus a bit more on brand marketers rather than just performance marketers. So what do the two of you make about that, Ronan?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting that this happens, and kudos to Tim Peterson, who, you know, found this story and dug it out, that it happened without the media owners necessarily knowing about it.
Yeah, correct.
And it goes to show, it's just another example, if we think back to the whole bid caching stuff, of just tweaks being done and publishers or media owners, whatever you want to call them, not necessarily being made aware of it. So it just goes to show, if you're a media owner and you rely on these big platforms, that, I mean, they don't always have your best interests at heart. Mm. So that's one point that reading through this piece that I felt was interesting.
Yep.
Probably what's really interesting is the fact that Roku, the role that they had in it, and it just goes to show we've got more and more walled gardens coming up. And ironically, what is one of the biggest difficulties the walled gardens of Facebook and Google are facing is more walled gardens. So it's just kind of, if you're a marketer trying to do attribution, it's going to be a huge headache. I mean,
I was going to say, you've just got a daily headache, really, don't you?
Yeah, I've heard of quite a few agency attribution tools just having to be closed down just because these tools they've built up for years, built on the cookie, etc., they're no longer fit for purpose. So, the rise of the walled garden has been accompanied by the sort of the fall of the easy attribution strategy, really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kieran?
I'm still trying to figure out who the Sage of Omaha is. hold on.
Well, that's a relief.
It's a... Anyway, getting back to that point. Facebook, right, okay. So Facebook desperately want access TV to TV money, right?
That was going to be my subsequent question. Is surely they're going to want to try to make another play and another move here, because this
Warren
is
Buffett.
Where...
It was Warren Buffett.
Right, great. This is where everyone will be so relieved that we got to that point. Because TV is where the opportunity is at, right? So surely they're going to want a piece of that pie.
So this is the conundrum that a lot... This is why I think TV is probably one of the most interesting spaces going, right? Facebook and Google are desperate to get access to that that money, right? They want that money, right? They want access to the TV money. Now, Facebook has built an amazing business, right? It's a scale business. Marketers love Facebook, segmentation, all the rest of it, right? But they don't see it as a brand safe, contextually safe environment for brand money, right? Advertisers still like TV, right? They still like TV shows, and they want to be around those specific TV shows, right? And obviously, Facebook have tried to build this network piece via their fan business, right? Facebook Advertising Network. And Roku is a good example of a company that has built out a really interesting platform to sort of access these TV dollars, right? And for a long time, that wasn't really their core business, right? Their core business was selling the Roku box, right, and getting access that way. But now it's like a big part of the business. I actually got someone from Roku, it's just started in London, connected, which is a sign that they're starting to see the ambitions grow globally, right? Mm. Now, Facebook are in a quandary here. Like, right, how do they act? Like, you know, there are various exercises around trying to build a TV-esque business like Watch and IGTV haven't been huge successes, right? And they're trying to encourage publishers to build content, right? But no publisher really wants to work with Facebook because there's no upside for them. They don't make any money out of advertising.
Well, as Ronan says as well, they're kind of rightly a little suspicious of how, what their business with Facebook is like.
It's inevitable that Facebook will buy Roku. It's just going to happen. It would be a foot in the door for them. It would solve a few problems, and then they could build on top of that. With Roku in their company, then they could expand. Whether they'll be allowed to buy them, I think that Facebook are in the crosshairs for a lot of anti-competitive behaviour. Well, for them to buy Roku would be seen as... I would guarantee you it would be blocked in Europe. And I would be surprised if it passed in the US. But Facebook now are in a growth cycle. As Brian Weezer says, there's only so much advertising, right? Facebook, Google are not creating a market. They're just taking money away from existing players. In this case, probably newspaper publishers just got bled dry of all the money, all the classifieds and all the advertising. Look at the problems that Johnson Press are facing. Currently in. They're about yep. to sell, they're sell, bit, selling their company by Bitmail. Like, it's a very sad reflection of that. But it's obvious to me that Facebook has to get in here. And, you know, they could either buy content, they could buy TV rights. But then the thing is, a lot of those sports bodies want to make sure they'll be seen on the TV, right? Mm. So Facebook have to ensure that they're still going to be seen on the TV, some shape or form, right?
And to your point about how they expand and grow, what they do next, what they might be allowed to do and all the rest of it. But the other thing about one of Brian Weezer's notes this week was, you know, he shared with us a kind of bullet point list of all the things that aren't going very well for Facebook at the moment and categorised them under two headings, kind of, you know, operational, managerial and strategic, and was effectively saying no matter what is going on, no matter what, you know, no matter what kind of financial position they're in, which is excessively strong, it's a company that's starting to show the signs of poor decision making and, what's the best way to phrase this politely, compromised management, operational management. And surely that's going to have an impact on what happens over the next 12 months or so. Kieran reckons no. What do you think, Ronan?
Brian's, very influential guy, and I think he's been, you know, quite vocal about his belief that of all the GAFA members, Facebook being the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
I think it's just kind of interesting how you were quite rightly talking about how Facebook needs to get into TV, really. I find it quite interesting at the upfronts this year in New York, how YouTube was actually on the closing night, and it was by far the biggest upfront there was. It was bigger than anything like CBS, AMC, etc.
Yep.
Whereas Facebook, they were quite absent from that. Can they get into the TV game? I seem to remember 3 earnings calls ago, they spoke quite a bit about how they were intending to invest in content creation in this next coming calendar year, 2019. So that will be interesting. But back to the whole walled gardens thing, I think the content owners are just getting a little bit wise to it. If we look at in Europe, we have the pan European TV body,
yeah.
Predominantly started by French and German broadcasters.
I believe, who are very powerful.
Channel 4 here in the UK is now getting in on the act.
Yeah.
I think if we have those kind of blocks setting up, who are very suspicious. I've seen of the publishing and newspaper publishing industry.
So they're rightly being very protective of their current businesses, right? Because they've seen the direction that they've gone in, that things have gone for publishers.
I wouldn't work with Facebook and Google if I was a broadcaster. I'd make them stay a million miles away. I wouldn't even let them near my ad server. I think it would be crazy, crazy for a broadcaster. And I'd say that mental to work with Google, considering they have...
For any broadcasters out there listening.
You want to be absolutely out of your little mind to work with Google in TV. They already have YouTube, which is a competitive to you. Like, the good thing about this is there's a couple of headwinds Google are going to... So there's a copyright law about to pass by the EU, which is basically going to really, really restrict YouTube on the type of content they can put on the platform. Because obviously, if they're contravening this legislation, that can be sued by the actual content owner themselves. And then obviously this means that Google have to filter all their content and figure out which is breaching this copyright law
and which isn't.
That is an incredibly difficult task.
Take a lot of time.
I mean, Susan Wojcik, is that her name?
Wojcicki.
Yeah, Wojcicki. She wrote this really like bleeding heart. Oh, poor Google. We're all
exactly how fair. She sounds.
My heart was breaking for them, like, you know.
What about if YouTube was separated out from Google?
That'd be amazing.
Well, it's Scott Galloway's solution, isn't it?
If Margaret Vestager listens to this blog, I know she this podcast. I know she's not, right? Because she never answers my feckin' tweets. She should be taking a look at this going, what? Google's an amazing company, but Google has five separate companies, independent companies, would be even better.
Yeah.
I mean, that means a concentration of ownership. I mean, I love Google, by the way. I love Google and I hate Google. I have a love-hate relationship with it. I think the company's amazing. I use all their products, but I hate the power they have.
And the dominance. Yeah.
And it's very different from Facebook. I just don't like Facebook, full stop. I don't like the CEO. I don't like the products. I like the ad business. It's amazing. That's different.
Their ad products are really,
they're amazing,
really good.
Right? But the products, who the fuck needs Facebook? If they disappeared tomorrow, I wouldn't care. Nobody needs it. Ever.
Final word on that. Ronan, anything else to say on that one?
No, how can I follow that?
It's often best not to, I find. And Margaret Vestager, if you are listening, please reply to Kieran's tweets because it does make him very upset.
I wrote
upset.
You 10 letters. I wrote you 10 letters and never replied any of them.
She's good mates with Scott Galloway, though, so maybe he can convince her.
Everybody wants to be mates with Galloway. He's so popular.
Okay, let's move on to the next section, which is a bit more of a focus on what you're up to, Ronan, over at Adweek. Mm-hmm. For listeners who are familiar with ExchangeWire, you might remember that Ronan Shields is one of our first editors.
Welcome back
here at ExchangeWire.
It's good to be back.
So, yes, it's fabulous to have him back here in the office, but it's also been with delight that we've watched his career flourish, and now you're based in New York and you're working for Adweek, and it sounds pretty exciting. So tell us.
He's also opened a bureau in South Armagh. That's in Northern Ireland, the occupied six counties, listeners.
Oh my goodness. I knew having two Irishmen in the podcast studio together was going to be dangerous. Yeah.
I said nothing.
Yeah. One of you's a bit worse behaved than the other one.
Time for me.
You remember the debates we used to have, Rachel?
Yes.
Let's go on to the next topic.
Yes. Let's talk about you and life in the US and Adweek.
Oh, thank you. Very, 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 very flattering. Obviously, been looking at a few things. Programmatic is pretty new to Adweek. I think, you know, being one of the more legacy titles, been focused on the creativity and the brand side of stuff. But obviously, I think myself coming on board, part of a great team, my editor, Josh Sternberg, he heads up our tech desk. Obviously, they've realized that, you know, this technology is underpinning everything. And that we need to start covering it in more detail. So that's kind of like why the desk I'm working on is relatively new. Yeah. We're in November, so it's only about a year old since started setting that up. In terms of what I'm looking at, one of the things is really quite interesting. So I have been away from Europe for 2 years now. One of the things I find really interesting is how they're trying to tackle ad fraud over there.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's if the industry here in Europe, as we were talking about earlier on, it being a bit more balkanized makes it more difficult. But there's certain things, I've been looking into it for quite a while, and through some of the industry trade bodies, they're at least talking about trying to get a few of the ad tech companies together where they can pool resources and knowledge and actually try and not only just shut some of the fraudulent activity down, but actually put people away.
Interesting.
Yeah. There are some talks, at least, and I'm still looking into this, about players doing that. So they would kind of have an exchange whereby they all share information, such as if there's some suspicious IPs generating fake traffic, that they'll know, okay, cut it down on this exchange, that exchange, et cetera, et cetera. And then maybe see about sharing that information with law enforcement, which is much easier said than done. I've spoken to some people about it, some anti-fraud researchers, some of the very popular or very vocal on the social medias. And they've said that that's actually quite a limited approach. You're just going to be playing whack-a-mole and never quite getting it. But I know that's the generic idea, at least from some of the people I've spoken to.
Interesting. It does sound like a sort of step beyond some of the approaches that we've been hearing about here in Europe. And, of course, you know Kieran's view of ad fraud, don't you, that it's necessary for the industry?
Kieran, why don't you share your opinion, just for the uninitiated?
So last week we spoke about ads.txt.
Mm.
Was it last week or the week before?
The week before, yeah.
And I put forward the theory that the reason why people do not buy
we're talking about how publishers have adopted it.
Right, 85% of the US.
They've embraced it, right?
And yet a small percentage of buyers are using it.
Buyers don't seem so interested.
So if you're a performance buyer, right, and you've got a CPA, if inventory started to go up in price, your CPA would increase as well. But if you manage to have some fraud trickle in the system, it brings the price down artificially because the Guardian has to chase yield, right? It has to. They'll all look at the long tail, right? And the buyers obviously need that price to be lowered. I don't know if this is actually orchestrated, but I think there's a kind of going, yeah, that's okay. That's all right. We're happy. Because I don't know, how could a buyer, a marketer, be happy with buying impressions?
I think, remember but when we were having
selling,
that discussion.
If you're selling, if your objective is to sell
this
something
is the thing. We were talking about how they might be incentivized and how the targets might be set and so forth, and it just might be creating a natural incentive to just not be so fussed about the type of inventory that you're buying.
I think in the US, and maybe Roland can correct me here, but the Adweek has been very much a marketer-first publication, very much around brand. Now, brand is obviously becoming more programmatic in the US, and there's a lot more brand money in the US, like full stop. It is I would say ads-ridden country, but like there's advertising everywhere. Marketing is at the core. In Europe, it's a bit more nuanced, if you will, like, you know, in a sense, to a point. I mean, if you look at US TV, the amount of ads you see during programs is insane.
So many.
I mean, they're very good ads, but like, you know,
well, not all of them.
Yeah, a lot of the pharma. The
pharmaceutical ads
are hilarious.
They're very strange.
The TNCs
to the uninitiated, very strange to see those on television.
You know, may kill you, may cause heartburn.
maybe the worst thing you've ever done in your life.
May give you kidney failure. But my point is that I guess the anti-fraud drive in the US is more pronounced because there's more brand focus, which I think is great because whatever the US do, the rest of us follow. So it's a good thing.
Would you agree with that, Ronan? Do you see that correlation, the brand, you know, brand focus, brand safety focus?
Oh, wow. I thought you were talking about the TV ads. I'd agree with that. It is pretty interesting. During the course of my inquiries about it, I heard a really interesting anecdote. Nothing I could get anybody on record, but apparently there was quite a big operation to trick down a bot network from somewhere in the East because... Here in the West, we all seem to think that it's all these fake traffic is coming from the East, which is a very lazy stereotype, in my opinion. But there were some pretty big players were involved in helping with the takedown of this bot network. And they were debating whether or not to PR this. And they decided against it because they were worried about them being the target of hackers. Yeah, which I found really, really
interesting. Did they actually close it down then, privately?
This is just something I was told, during the course of my inquiries. I've been trying to get everything firmed up, etc. But somebody was saying, like, they'd actually done something quite good, something quite positive. It was not insignificant, but kind of lost the bottle about talking about it openly because they're like, because we don't want to get
hacked. Worried about being a target. Yeah.
So I found that's probably the most interesting thing I've heard about fraud in
quite a while. A lot of people run these bots. Farms are criminals. It's like criminality. Like if you're a criminal, right, it's probably more easy to run a bot farm than do like human trafficking or drug trafficking. Because the margins are massive.
So. Well, there's probably a few less people involved.
Yeah, but a few really good coders in Belarus, right? a believable front business.
In the East again.
That piece that BuzzFeed did about the sophistication of that that bot operation in mobile. That is really smart. I have to say, that's pretty sophisticated stuff. So there's
but
the margins are huge, Rachel. It's if you think about how much money these people make, and like when you pay £15 CPM for a playable video, and on a site there's not any traffic, right? It's just basically bot traffic, and it plays it just over and over, autoplay. Those are incredible margins. Yeah. I mean,
but that's what's quite interesting about the US approach that Ronan's talking about, which is that they're trying to link it much more closely to the to it being criminal behaviour and criminal activity. Now, I don't know if you remember an ATS of about, 5 years ago, we had a copper come and talk to us. Do you remember?
Kicking the doors in.
Yeah, and he was running up, heading up a City of London, cybercrime unit.
Piku.
He was trying to make the point that this is, for lack of a better, more sophisticated way to describe it, it's a kind of a white collar crime, right? It's not something where people actually have to physically go out there and get their hands dirty and do something that they perceive as being immoral. It's just stuff that you can kind of tinker away on a computer and make happen. But his point was, it's crime nonetheless. And so, you know, the end result for them in combating it is that they do wind up kicking doors down. And I think that's probably that you know, that's what's interesting about the US approach. They're kind of trying to draw the correlation much more directly.
But it's so easy to do it. It's so easy to start this stuff up. I mean, and there's so many ad tech companies out there that would turn a blind eye to this stuff. I'm not saying all of them, but some will, right? When you hear about, oh, we've got X amount of demand and supply, I'm going, for video, how do you have that many users? When clearly outside of YouTube, there is no digital video at scale except on the broadcaster site, right? Outside of that, there's nothing except Outstream, which is, you know, completely different.
Which is
where there's mystery, there's margin, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
That old adage.
Shadow a little bit of opaqueness there. But that's maybe exactly why it's vendors that are leading the charge here then in the approach you're talking about, Ronan.
Yeah. I would say they are facilitating it. Okay. Similar to how we had that open letter written from the six exchanges. It's like, oh no, we're doing our best. We're doing good.
Yeah.
But yeah, when you look at a lot of the business challenges they face day to day, how much of a priority is this really?
Yeah.
I mean, look, there's been a lot of cases where companies have sold an ad tech where every dog in the street knew that they were just full of fraud. Like LiveRail was a good example. The Facebook acquisition, apparently it was an absolute shit show in terms of the fraud they had on that platform. And they had to close it down.
Mm.
And I don't know how nobody did proper due diligence on that. Like, you could have rang me or rang anybody in the space and they could have told you, well, look, you're buying a lot of crap there. Like, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And Facebook kept it quiet because it was embarrassing, right? 400 million for what? A bunch of bots. There's still money there, right? But I think this has got to be taken by the colour, by the people who hold the money, that's the brands, and say, I am not paying money for this crap anymore. And they need to get smart, and it's great to see that happening in the US.
Yeah.
And our boy Ronan at the forefront.
Leading the charge.
What a legend.
Yeah, it's a real experience calling up the FBI press office, asking them about ad fraud.
I was also going to ask, will it be federal? Will it, you know,
Yeah.
Rightly so.
It's at a level you couldn't ask for a police department to.
No, I know, but come on, over here in the UK, we get all a bit confused about this federal, local.
I think the FBI should start hiring ad ops people. Like, they'll actually have a team of ad ops team.
They do, they consult with people that are a bit,
white ops.
Poacher turned gamekeeper people.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah,
that's who the people I've been speaking to about this, and just slowly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to be watching that with interest, Ronan. I think we've run out of time. So thank you very much, Kieron.
Thank you. And it was good to have Ronan back.
Ronan back in exchange.
Very emotional times here. Well,
thanks.
We can hug it out in a bit.
We'll have a little cuddle.
A group hug.
And God bless Farzad as well.
Yes, absolutely.
What a legend.
All right. And that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.